and welcome to the Society of Biology podcast. I'm Rebecca Nesbitt, and I'm going to be exploring some of the complex ethical and scientific questions in conservation. As part of Biology Week, the Society of Biology has organised a debate on should we save the panda? It certainly sparked some interesting online discussion and some very strong views, but I don't think I'm the only one who really can't make up my mind. To help me decide what to think, I spoke to three conservationists of different backgrounds. First up was Dr. Mark Avery, one of the panellists from the panda debate. Mark, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, well, I guess I'm a bird watcher, interested in all of natural history, and I worked for the RSPB for 25 years, and the last 12 or so of those was conservation director. So I love nature, and I've been involved in nature conservation as a business.
And what made you want to become a conservationist?
I think the thing that's special about this planet that we live on is not all those people rushing around trying to make a living and deciding which football team to support, but the fact that it's got blue whales and robins singing and butterflies, and you can't get away from nature when we're part of it, and it's just fantastic. But there seems to be less and less of it, and we're losing it, and it needs some friends, so I think I'm a friend.
So it's clear that your primary interest is in birds, and these are quite charismatic animals that are popular with lots of people. So they can attract a lot of attention in terms of conservation funding compared to uglier or less noticeable species. Do you think the money spent on bird conservation and the protection of iconic species like the panda is justified?
Well, I do, but it's not that simple. So I'm not saying that all money spent on all iconic species is absolutely the best way that you could spend that money. But, you know, I don't know how you spend your money, but looking back, you'd go, maybe I shouldn't have bought that coat, or maybe that car wasn't the best purchase. But generally speaking, with a few kind of doubts about some of the details, I think conservationists spend their money very well. And more money comes for charismatic species. It's because people like them. Spending money on the skylark will help a lot of other species too, because it will mean we have a more sustainable agriculture, which will benefit all species, and it'll probably benefit farmers and us and the climate too. So it's not quite as simple as saying, should we spend money on things that are feathery or furry and look nice?
Sounds like conservation has really benefited from some of our favourite species. Do you think there are any species that have been neglected and need some more conservation attention?
Yes. I mean, I think if in the UK, if you look at how much money is spent on birds, even though that benefits lots of other species, isn't it amazing that organisations like Plant Life, which is dealing with all the plants, is so much smaller? And butterfly conservation, which, if you like, are the charismatic insects, and bug life, which is dealing with all invertebrates, they're a lot smaller than the RSPB. And that tells us something about the way that the world works. There's a bit of catching up to be done by the whole of nature that isn't a bird.
I would certainly second the need for lots of attention for insects. Now, if I were to give you a pot of money and say you can allocate it to any conservation project you like, what would you do with it?
You're going to give me a lot of money or just a bit of money? Because I think the answer differs a bit. So if you gave me a cheque for £100, I'd probably pass it on to the RSPB. And I wouldn't ask them what they were going to spend it on, because they need to spend money on new computers and cleaning the toilets as well as saving species. So I think that would be a good way, good place for it to be spent. But if we're talking about millions of pounds, then it becomes more difficult. And really, there are lots of choices. Two ways you could go: a conservation project like a reintroduction, or maybe buying land, extending a nature reserve, which is kind of bound to work in a way. It's, you're going to get something quite quickly for your money. Or we might think about spending it on trying to change the system, on employing people for several years to try to change agriculture policy, maybe across the whole of Europe, to try and make agriculture more friendly for birds, insects and plants. Now, I couldn't guarantee that that would work, but if it did work, it would be brilliant. If it didn't work, you'd have wasted your money in giving it to me. But those are the types of choices that conservation organisations are faced with all the time.
Could you give us a couple of examples of the conservation projects you've been involved with?
Yeah, I guess reintroductions would be one of them, which have always excited me. Birds like red kites, which I now see over my garden in Northamptonshire, and my kids who see them over our garden, they will be the first generation of children in that part of the world who've seen that bird for 100, 150 years. Then things like the RSPB bought a farm several years ago and are farming it to try to produce food, like every other farmer, but also to produce more wildlife. And that worked very well. So, you know, loads of different things.
That's really interesting. I think the red kites has to stand out as one of the conservation success stories of the last few years. Mark has just given me a lovely book to review for The Biologist, and I wondered whether you could tell me a little bit about this.
I could tell you that everybody ought to go out and buy a book called Fighting for Birds, 25 Years in Nature Conservation, which really is certainly not an autobiography, but there's quite a lot of me in it. And it talks about the way that nature conservation is done.
Thank you very much. So I'm here now with Zara Gladman. Zara, can you introduce yourself?
Hello, I recently submitted a PhD at the University of Glasgow in ecology.
And you were studying crayfish.
That's right.
Can you tell me what a crayfish actually is?
Well, a crayfish is a kind of crustacean. It's a decapod crustacean, so decapod means 10 legs. And crayfish, they look a bit like lobsters, but they're a bit smaller. And instead of finding them in salt water in the sea, you find them in fresh water.
And the crayfish you were studying are an invasive species?
That's right. So the species I study was the North American signal crayfish. And this is native to North America. And it was imported into Europe in the late 50s, early 60s, and has now spread very rapidly throughout Europe. And it's now the most widespread non-native crayfish species on the continent.
So are these invasive crayfish causing any problems?
They are, unfortunately. So by now, most people have heard about the negative impacts that invasive species can have. And it's always dangerous when you move a species outside of its native range. And crayfish are no different. Crayfish are considered keystone species. So that means that they have really major impacts on the communities that they're members of. They are omnivorous, which means they will eat anything from little invertebrates and plants to fish eggs. And they'll eat each other as well. So they impact the whole community. And as well as impacting the living parts of the ecosystem through predation, they also are competitors. So non-native species will compete with native European species. And another problem is that American non-native crayfish carry a disease called crayfish plague. And this disease, the native crayfish have pretty much no resistance to. And as well as this, the crayfish are also considered ecosystem engineers, and that means that they can modify the habitats that they're introduced to quite dramatically. They do that by digging burrows in the banks of rivers and the banks of lochs. That accelerates erosion of the riverbank and can quite quickly destroy the habitat of fish and other native animals. So they're a big problem.
So, I mean, arguably the panda is important to protect because people like it, but it sounds like the reasons for protecting our native crayfish are quite different.
Yeah, well, I can see why everybody wants to protect the panda. You know, they're big, they're cuddly, charismatic animals. But I would argue that the native crayfish are also definitely worthy of conservation. Firstly, because they're a lot more accessible than pandas. So the chance of you seeing a panda in the wild, your best chance is probably going to Edinburgh Zoo. Whereas crayfish, if you go down to your local river and just turn over a few stones, chances are you'll find one. So it's nice having, you know, easy access to wildlife. And crayfish, like I said before, they have really important roles in the ecosystem. They're a very diverse animal group. You know, there's over 600 species of crayfish. They come in all beautiful colours as well. And they're actually a quite important food source in a lot of countries, especially Scandinavia. Swedish people love crayfish, and they have, every August, they have crayfish parties.
So, obviously, the American signal crayfish is very invasive and causing problems here, but are invasive crayfish always a problem?
Well, you've got to be careful of the terminology. So, invasive means that the species is non-native and it's reached a level such that it is causing undesirable impacts on the ecosystem. But not all non-native species become invasive. In fact, quite a small percentage, I think it's 1 in 10 of introduced non-native species will actually become invasive and become a problem. So there are non-native species present in the UK that are not invasive. And one of them in Scotland is actually the white-clawed crayfish. So the white-clawed crayfish is native to Europe, which includes England and Wales, but interestingly, it doesn't include Scotland. So Scotland doesn't have any naturally native crayfish species. However, we do have two populations of the English white-clawed crayfish present. And given how endangered the white-clawed crayfish is in England and Wales and the rest of Europe as a result of the American signal crayfish being introduced, these populations in Scotland are actually viewed as quite valuable now. There's only two populations that we're aware of. As far as we know, they haven't spread from these locations and they haven't been having unwanted impacts on native species. But then again, there hasn't been any research to actually find out if they have done in the past because they've been there so long.
That's a very interesting situation where in England we have problems. We don't want the American crayfish because it's non-native, but in Scotland you're actively protecting a non-native crayfish, our English one.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a paradox. I think it's going to become a bigger issue in the future as well. There's other examples that in Australia there's a population of banteng, which are big sort of buffalo type animals, and they are native to Southeast Asia, and in their native range they're really, really endangered. But they were introduced to Australia. They're now doing very well there. Should we protect this species in Australia, even though it's not native? Because on a global scale, it's endangered.
So do you think this means that we should sometimes accept that non-native species are now part of our flora and fauna and not get too hung up about protecting wildlife and the environment exactly as it was when we found it?
I think realistically, the number of species invasions is going to accelerate. But not all species, not all native, non-native species will be having detrimental impacts. So I think we need to be realistic about which species we do want to target for management and which ones that we do accept, okay, they are pretty much naturalised now and in the grand scheme of things, it's maybe not that important.
Questions we're going to have to face.
Yeah.
So finally, I'm asking everybody this. If I gave you some money to spend on conservation, how would you spend it?
Oh, okay, that's quite tricky. I think I would give the money to any kind of conservation project that also engages the community that are living among whatever it is that you're wanting to protect. Because I think if people, you know, local people are engaged and realise the importance of conservation, you're more likely to be successful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm sitting here with Matthew Hatchwell from the Wildlife Conservation Society. Thank you for joining me, Matthew. Can you tell me a bit about what the Wildlife Conservation actually does?
The Wildlife Conservation Society is a US-based conservation organisation. I actually head up the Wildlife Conservation Society in Europe, but the organisation as a whole focuses on the conservation of wildlife and wild places worldwide, but with a particular focus on countries of high biodiversity, which tend to be developing countries in the tropics.
So do you have any examples of projects that WCS has been running recently, maybe some with a particular species in mind?
Yeah, an awful lot of our programs have their origins in work on a particular species. For example, one site where we've been working now for 25 years in northern Congo originated from surveys that we conducted on forest elephants throughout Central Africa. Until those first surveys, no one really had any idea at all how many elephants were out there in the forests of Central Africa. Those surveys led to the identification of particular areas that, you know, where there seemed to be very high elephant populations and not too much poaching. That led in turn to the creation of Nobali Ndoki National Park, which is in northern Congo, and that in turn led to initiatives working to reduce the external pressures on the national park, which were either coming from logging or to some extent from poaching and other human activities. Other species that have played a sort of similar role in terms of spawning conservation programs, might be tigers in Southeast Asia and some marine species as well, so cetaceans, humpback whales.
Do you think Britain has a responsibility to help with conservation in other parts of the world?
Very much so. Well, first of all, our first responsibility is to try and manage our own biodiversity as sustainably as we possibly can. Conservation here in the UK is a very different undertaking from the sort of work that the Wildlife Conservation Society does in other countries, because the landscapes here have been so influenced by humans over the centuries. You're not really talking any longer about maintaining natural systems. Even with the UK national parks, for example, you're talking about maintaining ecosystems that have been profoundly changed by humans. Whereas, to take the example of Central Africa, one's looking very much more at trying to protect ecosystems in something close to a natural state. In terms of responsibilities, the British government or the British people's responsibilities internationally, very supportive indeed of the idea that the UK should aim for this target of 0.7% of the national budget being allocated to foreign aid, and of course to foreign aid not being targeted exclusively on improving human livelihoods in the short term, but actually looking at the bigger picture and realising that human livelihoods in the long term depend on managing the environment sustainably.
So, if I could give you some money to donate to any aspect of conservation you like, what would you choose?
You have to go to one extreme or the other. The best way still to really have an impact for a single species would be to go to a particular site, where that species lives, and do whatever can be done to, first of all, protect the species, perhaps through the creation of a protected area, which has still been shown to be the most effective way of protecting any given species. But obviously that's of limited use if you don't address the threats that are impinging on that particular species. And that, generally speaking, that means working with local communities to identify other revenue sources, less damaging approaches they can take to agriculture or whatever. That would be one solution. The other one has to think about what people living in Europe, for example, or North America, can most easily do to benefit conservation and the sustainable management of ecosystems worldwide by becoming a vegetarian. Our dependence on meat in our diet is one of the things that increases pressure on tropical ecosystems. And the other one, of course, the other decision that people can make is to have fewer children in developed countries. That's a very difficult and personal decision for people to make.
Well, thank you very much for joining me. Finally, can I ask you, should we save the panda?
Yeah. I think there's a lot to be said for the conservation of these charismatic megavertebrates, pandas, elephants, tigers, whales, because they truly do serve as flagships for much larger aggregations of possibly less charismatic species. But I think most of all, if we're unable to safeguard such iconic species, there's no hope for all of the others, I'm afraid.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we've heard from three scientists, but I don't think scientists are the only people whose views are important in this debate. Biodiversity is essential for everybody, and we've all got a stake in its future. So I chatted to some friends and family about what they thought. Who should be responsible for setting conservation priorities? Scientists, politicians, everybody?
Well, unless you're going to embark on a protracted period of education, I don't think the average person has enough information to make an informed decision. So my vote would probably be for scientists.
And why do you think conservation is important?
Well, I think it's the responsibility of the human race to not to damage what is around it. It's a very simple ethical principle.
Are we ever justified in killing invasive species?
I believe yes. For example, in the instance of mink, if you let nature run its course and don't control them, you'll completely decimate populations of things like water vole. So I think in certain situations, yes, you have to do something.
And if a species is particularly impressive to humans, should we do all we can to save it?
If we're saving a species just because it looks nice and we like to have it around, that's great, but it's an absolute luxury. It's not a duty in the way that preserving an ecosystem is.
Is it more important to save species who are beautiful?
I don't think it's more important to save them if they're beautiful. I think it's more important to ensure that the species that are saved are those that contribute to the ecosystem, and also that we think about general balance. Certain species, well, all species should be hopefully allowed to continue to exist. Otherwise, we're taking our role for granted.
And do you think in England we've got a responsibility for conservation in other parts of the world as well as here?
I think it's in our own interests to try and ensure that the health of ecosystems around the world is maintained, and so therefore we do have a responsibility. I'm not even sure that responsibility is the right word. It's in our interest to do so.
If an animal which is really widespread elsewhere in its range is struggling in England, should we try and protect it here?
I think we've got to remember that actually extinction is a natural process, and if an animal becomes extinct in England, we've got to let that happen.
And finally, I asked my colleagues at the Society of Biology, should we save the panda?
Yes, because if we can't save the iconic fluffy species, then we won't save any of them.
No, because we spend too much pointless money on trying to save a species that doesn't help us at all.
Yes, because they're very cute, and I think it's good to have a species as the face of conservation.
Yes, because it's a great flagship species of conservation.
Can I see maybe?
Yes, I think we should, because the bamboo forests are endangered, and so if we protect the panda, we have to protect the bamboo forests.
Maybe.
Thank you for listening to the Society of Biology podcast. The Society of Biology's aim is to support everyone who has an interest in biology and to promote the life sciences to the public and policymakers. For more information or to get involved, you can visit our website, www.societyofbiology.org, follow us on Twitter at @society_biology, or find us on facebook.com/societyofbiology.